Pain and suffering are almost inevitable for a large intelligence and a deep heart. The really great men must, I think, have great sadness on earth. Fyodor Dostoevsky from Crime and Punishment.
Welcome everybody to the podcast, Two Guys Searching for Truth on the Road That Never Ends. I'm Credo, and my co-host is Glaucon.
We both invite you to take historical ideas within their context along with us, examine the thinkers and the timeless ideas they provide to us. These ideas are as relevant today as they were back then.
It's our hope and our belief that in doing so would bring us closer to the truth. Just note that the views expressed by the host do not in any way reflect the personal views of the host themselves.
All right, let's do this.
Okay, so tonight we're going to pick up where we left off on our last episode. And so we're going to start with Agathon. And he was a tragic playwright. He was also the host of the banquet that Socrates and all these other individuals are at. And again, just to bring you up to speed, they're giving speeches on what they believe Eros is, or it's a speech that they can dedicate to Eros, the god of love. And Agathon starts off by kind of taking the angle that, again, like people before him, he wants to build on the ideas before him, but kind of clarify or point out some nuance maybe that someone missed before him. So he starts off by saying, quote, "The previous speakers, instead of praising the god Eros or unfolding his nature, appear to have congratulated mankind on the benefits which he confers upon them. But I would rather praise the god first and then speak of his gifts. This is always the right way of praising everything." So again, here, you know, he really wants to separate the idea of Eros's nature from what mankind or humankind seems to associate him with, but it's not actually him, it's actually the benefits that we get from him, right? So he then says, quote, "Eros is the fairest, for in the first place, he is the youngest." Now this goes back to one of the first speakers that we spoke of saying that in the beginning there was basically love, and that was Phaedrus. And so he then says, "And of his youth, he is himself the witness, fleeing out of the way of age, who is swift enough, swifter truly than most of us. Eros hates him and will not come near him, but youth and love live and move together, like to like, as the proverb says." Now this kind of caught my attention in particular, how youth and love are associated here. And again, this is something that we kind of mention a lot in the sense that many of the things that they mention here were as true then as they are true now, and this is certainly no exception. It's interesting how people do say that not only love keeps them younger, but that youthfulness and love, they just always seem to be kind of hand in hand, and it's just interesting to see it mentioned in this context. He also mentions, quote, "Of a truth, he is the tenderest as well as the youngest, and also he is of flexible form, for if he were hard and without flexure, he could not enfold all things or wind his way into and out of every soul of man undiscovered." Again, hitting on that same universal principle, the idea that love can enter every nook and cranny of both the individual as well as the world. We've heard from Eryximachus saying that medicine is really just love, and that the way in which the earth, you know, experiences things, whether it be rain or drought or anything like that, is also just a form of love to the earth. To some degree. He then goes on to mention the qualities of Eros. He says, quote, "His greatest glory is that he can neither do nor suffer wrong to or from any god or man. For he suffers not by force if he suffers. Force comes not near him. Neither when he acts does he act by force. For all men in all things serve him of their own free will. And where there is voluntary agreement, there is justice. And not only is he just, but exceedingly temperate, for temperance is the acknowledged ruler of the pleasures and desires. And no pleasure ever masters Eros. He is their master, and they are his servants. And if he conquers them, he must be temperate indeed. As to courage, even the god of war is no match for him. He is the captive and Eros the lord. For love, the love of Aphrodite, and the master is stronger than the servant. And if he conquers the bravest of all others, he must himself be the bravest. So just to stop here for a second, this goes back to how I originally started this in explaining that he really wants to pull out the qualities of Eros, the god of love, and what his nature or her nature, how an individual wants to see that god. What is the nature of that god? Kind of like how we look at the nature of what the nature of the good is. He then goes on to say, he is also the source of poesy in others. This kind of also made me take a second to realize that, wow, that is actually true. When you think about a lot of poetry, a lot of it, the source of the poetry is either the love for someone, and so it kind of inspires that work, or, you know, it is the topic itself is love. And we can actually see this in, you know, beyond poetry, including artwork and other things. He says he is also the source of poetry in others, which he could not be if he were not himself a poet. Now that's interesting. He then goes on to say, and at the touch of him, everyone becomes a poet, even though he had no music in him before. So again, this is the love that can kind of overtake an individual and turn them into a poet, even though, you know, they're not a poet themselves. It's just the love is kind of the poetry acting within them. This is also a proof that Eros is a good poet and accomplished in all the fine arts. For no one can give to another which he has not himself, or teach that of which he has no knowledge. Who will deny that the creation of animals is his doing? And are they not all the works of his wisdom born and begotten of him? The arts of medicine and archery were discovered by Apollo under the guidance of love and desire, so that he too is a disciple of Eros. So this is interesting because it makes Apollo a disciple of Eros. He then says, and the melody of the muses, the weaving of Athena, the empire of Zeus over gods and men are all due to Eros, who was the inventor of them, and the reason for kindness, banquets, desire, regard for the good, and so on. So this is excessive, possibly at first glance. You know, it's actually quite telling, though, of what reality really is. Because if one were to look from the outside, as, say, for example, like an alien looking into the world, and an alien that had never experienced love, it would seem that love itself isn't only everywhere, but that love is one of the strongest driving and motivating factors or forces out there. I mean, think about, like, you know, throughout the history of all the things which were inspired or created or done because of love. You know, we mentioned about the Iliad early on, but there's so many examples of things which, you know, love was. I mean, think about how many songs are about love or through love. Think about, you know, the acts, the brave acts that people do, the things they do for their children, the sacrifices they make for the love of their kid. You know, it's pretty amazing how once you realize if there were a hierarchy, you would have to kind of put love at the top, because it does seem that everything is subservient to it to some degree. And then it goes on, you know, really just to reinforce this idea that if the god of love is not the greatest, taking all of that into consideration, then, like, I don't know what to tell you. I mean, how can it not be the greatest when it seems to be the greatest thing that there is and the greatest motivating factor behind all the things that we do?
Yeah, that's definitely a great summation of his point, really, Agathon's point. And what's interesting about this discourse, his discourse, is that Socrates is going to come and kind of say, look, that's a bunch of rhetoric. Let me give you a different take on this. And so what's interesting is that if you really read between the lines here, of what they're saying that all of these gods, quote unquote, with a lowercase g, right? Apollo and Hephaestus, who was a semi-god, and Athena, right? So the work that they're doing because of love. And so what could that mean? Well, remember Descartes said, all the mysteries and treasures of the sciences lay hidden in God. And we also know that Plato thinks that the form of the good contains all the other forms and all knowledge. Anything that's actually real and true is in the form of the good. And so here, it seems like, right, all of these different ways in which love is functioning that are kind of given to us here in this discourse are ways in which people are trying to be excellent, achieve the good, the true, and the beautiful, express that. And that's also what's done by the poets and the musicians. So it is another example of how in Plato we have these different elements of an idea expressed by different characters in a dialogue And it's not always true that one trumps another one and just cuts it out of the picture or something like that. There's always some way in which there is a real element of truth, I think, in what each person's saying.
Yeah, I think that's a really good way to put it because, you know, when you start thinking about it, there are also a few through lines in what they're saying too about being universal and other things and kind of permeating everywhere. But no, you're absolutely right when it comes to just kind of taking them both individually and collectively, I think is the best way you can approach this and the best way to see, you know, what Plato and Socrates are really trying to get across. And speaking of, how does Socrates begin his speech?
So what he says, it's pretty comical, and that's nothing new for Socrates, right? He says, "Why, my dear friend, must not I or anyone be in a strait who has to speak after he has heard such a rich and varied discourse?" So Socrates is basically complaining that he has to go after this guy. Like, how can you follow that up, right? How am I supposed to follow this guy, right? He says, "I am especially struck with the beauty of the concluding words. Who could listen to them without amazement? When I reflected on the immeasurable inferiority of my own powers, I was ready to run away for shame if there had been any possibility of escape." And so here we get this self-effacement, Socratic position that, look, I don't know much about anything, right? And so then he goes on and says, "Whereas I now see that the intention was to attribute to love every species of greatness and glory, whether really belonging to him or not, without regard to truth or falsehood. That was no matter, for the original proposal seems to have been not that each of you should really praise love, but only that you should appear to praise him." So this is a kind of interesting statement, right? So he says, you're attributing everything that you can possibly attribute to love. And as we alluded to earlier, right, it's going to turn out that love actually can't even be a god. But that doesn't mean that the source of love or what is loved can't be a god, right? So that's a different thing. And so then he goes on to say, "And so you attribute to love every imaginable form of praise which can be gathered anywhere. And you say that he is all this and the cause of all that, making him appear the fairest and best of all those who know him or not. For you cannot impose upon those who know him. Those who don't know him, you can make this." So what Socrates is saying here, this is pretty interesting. He's saying basically that for the people that don't know love, you can make this claim and it sounds fine. But for people that do know love, you can't make this kind of a claim and it's not fine. Right? So, you know, we'll see whether or not Socrates can back this up. So then he goes on to say, "But if you like to hear the truth about love, I'm ready to speak in my own manner. Though I will not make myself ridiculous by entering into a rivalry with you. Say then, Phaedrus, whether you would like to have the truth about love, spoken in any words and in any order which may happen to come into my own mind at the time. Will that be agreeable to you?" So, as we saw in the Apology, Socrates starts off by saying, "Hey, let me do this in my own way. Let me do this in my own style, if you want to get at the truth of what's happening here." So he wants to be able to do this in the way that he likes to do things. And it's going to involve a back and forth with questions and answers, right? Which is, we know Socrates loves to do that. So then he says, "Whether love is the love of something or of nothing. And here I must explain myself. I do not want you to say that love is the love of a father or the love of a mother. That would be ridiculous. But to answer as you would, if I asked, is a father of something? To which you would find no difficulty in replying, a son or a daughter. And that answer would be right." And he says, "Very true," said Agathon. "And would you say the same of a mother?" "Yes," he assented. "Yet let me ask you one more question in order to illustrate my meaning. Is not a brother to be regarded essentially as a brother of something?" "Certainly," replied. "That is, of a brother or a sister?" "Yes," he said. "And now," said Socrates, "I will ask about love. Is love of something or of nothing?" "Of something," surely, he replied. "Keep in mind what this is and tell me what I want to know, whether love desires that of which love is." "Yes, surely. And does he possess or does he not possess that which he loves and desires?" "Probably not, I should say." And this goes back to what we kind of alluded to earlier, that the person that is doing the loving has a deficiency. And this is the point that Socrates is bringing out here. And then he says, "Nay," replied Socrates, "I would have you consider whether necessarily is not rather the right word. The inference that he who desires something is in want of something, and that he who desires nothing is not in want of anything. This is my judgment." "Absolutely and necessarily true," he agrees. Agathon agrees. So there we get this kind of idea we were talking about earlier, right? And then he goes on to say, "Very good. Would he who is great desire to be great, or he who is strong desire to be strong?" And then he says, "Well, that wouldn't be consistent with what we said before." And so here we get this idea that we've got an idea, but now we need to refine it. And we need to make sure that there aren't some counterexamples that negate our point. And so here, the problem with this is that you might want to stay strong, right? You might want to stay healthy, for example. So I desire to be healthy, but I also desire to stay healthy, right? So then he says, then he and everyone who desires that which he has not already, and which is future and not present, and which he has not and is not, and as of which he is in want. These are the sort of things which love and desire seek. Very true. Then love wants and has not beauty. Certainly. So love wants but does not have beauty. And would you call that beautiful which wants and does not possess beauty? Certainly not. And so this goes back to what we were saying about the gods and the idea that a perfect, complete thing is not going to want anything. So is not actually going to be loving anything. Is not going to be in a state where they are going to be required to love anything. And so then he goes on to say, and now, taking my leave of you, I would rehearse a tale of love, which I heard from Diotima of Manitinae, a woman wise in this and in many other kinds of knowledge, who in the days of old, when the Athenians offered sacrifices before the coming of the plague, delayed the disease 10 years. She was my instructress in the art of love, and I shall repeat to you what she said to me. So this has always been something that I've just found to be really interesting, right? So they're having this party. They're talking about sex and love. Socrates gets his turn to talk about sex and love. And he basically says, well, everything I know about this, I learned from an older woman, right? Basically, when he was a young man. So he was in a relationship with Diotima, and she taught him what he feels to be is the most profound stuff that he knows. So he's basically saying, this is his teacher, right? This is interesting for a couple of reasons. First of all, it's a female, and that's not going to be at all something that's going to be a normal thing that's going to happen in ancient Greece. Second of all, as you remember, the whole beginning of the symposium, everything we've talked about so far, has been kind of focused on this relationship, the primary relationship being between an old man and a young man, and the instruction between an old man and a young man, and this idea of imparting wisdom from an old man to a young man. And then here, Socrates says, everything I've learned, I learned from an old woman. Right? So here, it's very interesting, right, that would be the way that this is portrayed, right? So Socrates is actually, and Plato, I think, right, is making this point that he also made in the Republic, that there needs to be equality, you know? And here, Socrates saying, this is where I got my wisdom. And everybody thinks Socrates is the wisest guy of all time ever, right? Alcibiades just basically thinks he's the only person that anybody should pay attention to. And Apollodorus, the guy that's telling this story right now, is the same, thinks that Socrates is the only person that anybody should pay any attention to. And here Socrates is telling us that the person that I got my wisdom from is this woman, right? So it's an interesting side note anyway. So then from there, he goes on. I must speak first of the being and nature of love, and then of his works. Firstly, I said to her in nearly the same words which he used to me, that love was a mighty god, and likewise fair. And she proved to me, as I proved to him, that, by my own showing, love was neither fair nor good. What do you mean, Diotima? I said. Is love then evil and foul? Hush, she cried. Must that be foul which is not fair? Certainly, I said. So here she says, love is not fair or good. So completely negating what Agathon said, right? And then he says, well, what might it be? And then she says, right opinion. And then this is just a crazy answer, right opinion. So right opinion, she replied, which is, as you know, being incapable of giving reason is not knowledge, for how can knowledge be devoid of reason? Nor again ignorance, for neither can ignorance attain the truth, but is clearly something which is a mean between ignorance and wisdom. So if I'm completely ignorant, I don't know the answer at all. If I'm wise, if I have real wisdom, I know the truth. If I have right opinion, I know what's true, but I don't know why. So it's kind of in between those two. Quite true, I replied. Do not then insist, she said, that what is not fair is of necessity foul, and what is not good evil, or infer that because love is not fair and good, he is therefore foul and evil, for he is in a mean between them. Love is surely admitted by all to be a great god, but those who know are by those who do not know, by all. And how, Socrates, she said with a smile, can love be acknowledged to be a great God by those who say that he is not a God at all? And who are they? I said, you and I are two of them. So she's saying that Socrates is saying that he's not a God, but Socrates just said he's a God, right? So she said, how can that be true by people that don't think he's a God at all? And she says, you and I are two of them. How can that be? It is quite intelligible, she said. For you yourself would acknowledge that the gods are happy and fair, of course. You would. Would you dare to say that any god was not? Aren't they happy and fair? Aren't they perfect in every way? And you mean by the happy those who are possessors of things good and fair, yes? And you admitted that love, because it was a want, desires those good and fair things of which it is in want? Yes, I did. But how can he be a god who is not, has no portion in what is either good or fair? Impossible. Then you see that you also deny the divinity of love. So here she's basically saying, love is not a god. And then, what is he? He asks his teacher. And she says, he is a great spirit. And like all spirits, he is intermediate between divine and mortal. And what, I said, is his power? He interprets, she replies, between gods and humans, conveying and taking across to the gods the prayers and sacrifices of humans, and to humans the commands and replies of the gods. He is the mediator who spans the chasm which divides them. And therefore, in him, all is bound together, and through him the arts of the prophets and priests, their sacrifices and mysteries and charms, and all prophecy and incantation find their way. For God mingles not with them, but through love all the intercourse and converse of God with man, whether awake or asleep, he is carried on. So here, love is the ability for humans to communicate with the divine, with the perfect. And now we kind of get back to this idea of worship and religion, and the role of prayer, supplication to the gods, and that, she's arguing, is what happens through the medium of love. Now, any thoughts about that?
Yeah, I mean, if we go back to, so not the last one, but the one before, Aristophanes, his idea that we're kind of split in half, we're looking for our other half to complement us, I think it's pretty fascinating that here you see a similar idea in the sense that gods had made us kind of imperfect, right? That the curse of man, which, you know, has been repeated, but this notion, like he's saying, or she's saying rather, that it's a spirit in this intermediate between us kind of shows by definition that we're imperfect, right? That we don't have a direct connection with the god, which is interesting because it shows that we are deficient. So then let me ask this to follow up on that. Is it that we need this spirit to communicate with God because we are imperfect, because God's had made us imperfect? Or what do you think Socrates would say about that in the context of Aristophanes and his notion that, you know, when these beings had challenged the gods, they got split in half? You know, does that have any connection to this, or do you think those two things are unrelated?
I think they're unrelated, because the idea of beings being split in half and them becoming whole again is kind of trying to explain the love or lack. It's for your other half. But here, the deficiency in you is not because you've been split in half. The deficiency is caused by your imperfections. So each one of us is unique because of our imperfections. We would all be identical if we were perfect. We would all be the same as God. And I think that the action of loving is not actually symmetric. It's asymmetric. So it's only coming from the deficient side. So I think we are sensitive to the immortal and the perfect. And so that sensitivity is directed at something that is the source of that. So that's kind of how it comes from that side. But the act of loving, I think, from our side, has its root cause in our deficiency and our recognition of perfection, if that makes sense. And so then when we do things like we recognize that we have this moral imperative, we recognize that we have this call to perfection, and then we try to act on it and we try to relate to it in a good way, that's going to turn out to be the kind of basis for that kind of religious activity that they're attributing to love here.
Okay.
All right, so going on from there. But someone will say, of the beautiful in what, Socrates and Diotima? Or rather, let me put the question more clearly and ask, when a person loves the beautiful, what does he desire? I answered her, that the beautiful may be his. Still, she said, the answer suggests a further question. What is given by the possession of beauty? To what you have asked, I replied. I have no answer ready. Then she said, let me put the word good in the place of the beautiful and repeat the question once more. If he who loves the good, what is it that he loves? The possession of good, I said. And what does he gain who possesses good? Happiness, I replied. And so here we get the idea that, right, Diotima is basically teaching Socrates the fundamental basis of his entire view, right? Because this is basically like a quick thumbnail sketch of Plato's entire picture of reality, right? The good, happiness, beauty, the idea of something like the form of the good that we're directing ourselves towards. So all of these things are already kind of here, contained in this discussion, right? And so he goes on to say, there is poetry which, as you know, is complex and manifold. All creation or passage of non-being into being is poetry or making, and the process of all art are creative, and the masters of arts are all poets or makers. Very true. Still, she said, you know that they are not called poets, but have other names, only the portion of the art which is separated off from the rest and is concerned with music and meter is termed poetry. And they who possess poetry in the sense of the word called poets. Very true, I said, and the same holds of love. For you may say generally that all desire of good and happiness is only the great and subtle power of love. But they who are drawn towards him by any other path, whether the path of money-making or gymnastics or philosophy, are not called lovers. The name of the whole is appropriate to those whose affection takes one form only. They alone are said to be love or to be lovers. I dare say, I replied, that you're right. Yes, she added, and you hear that people say that lovers are seeking for their other half, but I say that they are not seeking for their other half of themselves, nor for the whole, unless that half or the whole be also a good. And they will cut off their own hands and feet and cast them away if they are evil, for they love not what is their own. So that's pretty hardcore stuff, right? You're going to cut your hand off and throw it away, right? And so it's a shocking idea. And what's interesting is that idea is something that Christ actually says, right? He says, if your eye offends you, pluck it out. Or if your hand offends you, cut it off. So this is actually the same kind of idea right here that, look, our priorities are messed up. And the reason why that sounds shocking to you is because your priorities are messed up. Your priority should be loving the good. And if anything is not good, that you shouldn't love that. So that's basically making that point in a very dramatic way. And then, so then we get this interesting kind of summation by Diotima. She says, then love may be described generally as the love of the everlasting possession of the good. And then Socrates says, that is most true. I mean to say that all men bringing to birth in their bodies and in their souls, there is a certain age at which human nature is desirous of procreation. Procreation must be in a beauty and not in deformity. And this procreation is the union of man and woman and is a divine thing, for conception and generation are an immortal principle in the mortal creature. Inharmonious, they can never be. So interesting. So now we get this discussion of procreation, immortality, mortality. So I don't know, a while ago, 20 or 30 years ago, I was thinking about things one day, and I thought to myself, you know, in a certain sense, human beings do kind of participate in immortality when they have kids. And we have, you know, come from a long line of living beings, right? To be the being we are now. And so we're not as mortal or kind of temporally limited as we think. But we just have this perspective because of our kind of like inability to be kind of broad-minded about the nature of existence or consciousness or something like that. We like to think just about our own lives. It is actually true, though, that if I do have children and they have children and they have children, that there is some way in which I'm kind of trying to participate in immortality. And so this is, I think, kind of what she's talking about here. And so then he goes on to say, because to the mortal creature, generation is a sort of eternity and immortality. And if it has been already admitted, love is of the everlasting possession of the good. All men will necessarily desire immortality together with the good, wherefore love is of immortality. So she's making the argument that the natural object of love is immortal goodness, which is basically, you know, like a perfect god or something like that, or the form of the good or something like that, right? And what I pine after, what I desire is that, right? And so what's interesting is a lot of religions, right, have this kind of idea, right? So Christ is like a perfect being that's immortal. Buddha is a perfect being that's immortal, right? You have the idea of the eight immortals in Chinese thought. And so there's a very common idea that once people attain perfection, they become immortal. And so it's like a basic human thing that we pine after, right?
Yeah, and it's actually kind of even obvious. I mean, people say God is love, you know, all the time, right?
Right.
And so it's kind of that same, it's like an embodiment, kind of like we renamed love and tried to cast it with the quality she's mentioning here, you know, and basically string a set of principles to it, and, you know, it's a religion.
That's right. That's right. And then she talks a little bit about the stuff you mentioned before about mothers wanting to protect their young. You know, everybody knows, you know, well, I don't know if everybody knows, but some people know that you shouldn't go between a mommy bear and her cubs, right? You shouldn't separate those because the mommy bear is going to, like, try to kill you. And a moose will try to kill you if you get between it and its baby. And we know human beings, right, will do very crazy things to try to protect their children and go to extreme lengths. So that is definitely a good point.
It's participating in the immortality, like you were saying.
Right, exactly. And so it's because it's that part of you. You recognize it in some, like, deep way. You know, it might not be conscious to you, but it is actually a recognition of that. At least that's the point she's making here, right? And so then going on from there, those who are pregnant in the body only betake themselves to women and beget children. This is the character of their love, their offspring, as they hope, will preserve their memory and give them the blessedness and immortality which they desire in the future. But souls which are pregnant, so this is different now, but souls which are pregnant, for there certainly are people who are more creative in their souls than in their bodies, conceive that which is proper for the soul to conceive or contain. And what are these conceptions? Wisdom and virtue in the general. Okay, and such creators are poets and all artists who are deserving of the name inventor. But the greatest and fairest sort of wisdom, by far, is that which is concerned with the ordering of states and families. So we're talking about temperance and justice. And he who is in youth has the seed of these implanted in him, and himself is inspired. When he comes to maturity, desires to beget and generate. So that's basically like the philosopher trying to understand how to live the virtuous life, how to organize a state so that it's a just state. And so here, we know Socrates thinks of himself as a midwife giving birth to ideas sometimes. And so I think this is related to this point, obviously, right? So if you're able to produce with your mind ideas, and really this is contradictory to recollection, right? Because recollection is not inventing or producing, it's discovering or remembering. So when I discover mathematical principles that are unchanging and perfect, I'm basically touching the immortal in a different way, not in a way that is possible with a physical body, but with my mind. So I'm not giving birth to a child, which kind of touches the immortal, or at least has the potential of something like immortality. But when I recognize these perfect and pure ideas, I am really touching the immortal in a different way with my mind and not using my body.
Yeah, that's actually really interesting, because when you think about it, she also explains or mentions, you know, Achilles, who died avenging Patroclus, as we mentioned before, to preserve the kingdom for his sons, right? Now, this is more of in a material context, but and that in some way is also the desire to touch the immortal. But I was wondering, how much of this do you think reflects in some ways or foreshadows Socrates, right? That in Plato, not only in preserving the works of someone who recorded nothing, right? That is kind of playing into immortality. Of course, he wouldn't have known the legacy that Socrates would go on to have. But I did think about Socrates also in the material context as well, as dying for his principles, kind of like Achilles in some way, right? To basically participate in future generations who would then either be saved by him, so to keep the kingdom, or in Socrates' case, to keep his philosophy alive and well, and to basically become a martyr and inspire future generations.
Right. No, absolutely. I think that is around, because the discussion really does sound like that. And we know that Socrates' ideas do stand the test of time. You know, and it's interesting that they're talking about inventing these ideas and being creative to come up with these ideas, because in a sense, if it's true, it's not really creative and it's not really invented. So it is kind of a funny little problem there. So then he goes on to say, but beauty, absolute, separate, simple, and everlasting, which without diminution and without increase or any change is imparted to the ever-growing and perishing beauties of all other things, he who from these ascending under the influence of true love begins to perceive that beauty is not far from the end. So here, this sounds like the allegory of the cave, right? Where he's coming out of the cave and he's starting to perceive the real beauty and actually seeing it as it really is and experiencing it as it actually is. And so, and then the last word is not far from the end. So that sounds like you're going to be, you know, removing yourself from the mortal realm, right? And then he goes on to say, remember how in that communion only, beholding beauty with the eye of the mind, and this is like what we were just saying a minute ago about these perfect ideas, he will be enabled to bring forth not images of beauty, but realities. For he has held not of an image, but of a reality, and bringing forth and nourishing true virtue to become the friend of God and be immortal, if mortal man may. So that's just what we were talking about, right? And in classic Platonic Socratic fashion, he says, if mortal man may. He doesn't say it's a fact. He doesn't say that it's going to happen. He says, if it's possible, that's the way it would work. And it's an interesting idea. You know, and then he says, such were the words of Diotima, and I am persuaded of their truth. And being persuaded of them, I try to persuade others that in the attainment of this end, human nature will easily find a helper better than love. And therefore, also, I say that every person ought to honor him as I myself honor him, and walk in his ways, and exhort others to do the same, and praise the power and spirit of love according to the measure of my ability now and ever. So what's interesting here is, like I said, he's basically attributing his entire philosophical endeavor and his life, how he lives, on his teacher, Diotima. So he's basically saying, it's because I think she taught me correctly that I do this now. So it's pretty puzzling and interesting that that is what's being said here, you know? So we have to wonder about that.
This, I think, to go back to Diotima for a second, as a teacher, I think it's pretty powerful when she explains that in participating in love, you begin to see and experience kind of something that is incomparable to everything around you, so much so that she says, this, my dear Socrates, is that life above all others which man should live in the contemplation of beauty absolute, a beauty which, if you once beheld, you would see not to be after the measure of gold and garments and fair boys and youths whose presence now entrances you. And again, I think that kind of goes back to all we've been saying, but I think it's really well put, and it's another angle that we can see, you know, the idea of the good. We can see the idea of being able to rise above our material existence and try to participate in the amazing benefit that we get as humans, which is our ability to actually experience the non-material, you know, the good. And I think it's just really well put the way she kind of references that.
No, absolutely. That's exactly right. So after that discussion about his teacher, Socrates is now replaced by Alcibiades, who kind of crashes the party and shows up really drunk. So he shows up really drunk and he's shouting, where's Agathon? He's super, basically he's drunk and he's rowdy. He was known to be a rowdy guy and known to not follow the rules. He was also a serious warrior who fought, was a general at one point, was involved with the Spartans, and was no one to toy with, basically. And he was also a very, very handsome person. And lots of people basically were in love with him. And he thought the only person worthwhile was Socrates. And so Alcibiades was actually in love with Socrates, right? In the sense of loving Socrates for his virtue, but also loving Socrates as a person, right? So he loved Socrates, and he tried to seduce Socrates, and Socrates resisted it. And he talks about this when he talks about love, right? So he goes on and he says, Socrates turned to Agathon and said, I must ask you to protect me, Agathon, for the passion of this man has grown quite a serious matter to me. Since I became his admirer, I have never been allowed to speak to any other fair one. So Alcibiades gets upset when Socrates talks to another handsome person. Right? He goes, if I do, he goes wild with envy and jealousy, and not only abuses me, but can hardly keep his hands off me. And at this moment, he may do me some harm. Please see to this. So Socrates is like saying, you know, protect me from this crazy guy. He's like after me. So basically, Alcibiades shows up and he's like this guy that's like in love with Socrates and he's crashing the party and then he's like going to start talking about love. And he's like, Socrates is like, well, you know, this guy's basically got a crush on me. So then he goes on and he says, observe, my friends, Alcibiades, that the ingenious trick of mine will have no effect on Socrates, which is to drink, because he just wants everybody to get drunk. So Alcibiades wants everybody to get drunk. And he says, Socrates can drink as much wine as he wants and he never gets drunk. So this is something that was said about Socrates, that he could drink all night with people and then wouldn't really get drunk, which would just like carry on. And this is what happens actually in the symposium. But so he goes on and he says, I shall praise Socrates, Alcibiades now, in a figure which will appear to him to be a caricature. And yet I speak not to make fun of him, but only for the truth's sake. I say that he is exactly like the busts of Silenius, which are set up in the statuary shops, holding pipes and flutes in their mouths, and they are made to be open in the middle and have images of gods inside them. So if you open him up, there's images of gods inside of him. He would transfix me, and I should grow old sitting at his feet, for he makes me confess that I ought not live as I do, neglecting the wants of my own soul and busying myself with the concerns of the Athenians. Therefore I hold my ears and tears myself away from him. So basically, when he's around Socrates, Socrates makes him want to be a different kind of person than he is. And we know that Socrates always does that. He wants people to be virtuous. And he is the only person who ever made me feel ashamed, which you might think not to be in my nature. And there is no one else who does the same. For I know that I cannot answer him or say that I ought not to do as he bids. But when I leave his presence, the love of popularity gets the better of me. And therefore I run away and fly for him. And when I see him, I am ashamed of what I have confessed to him. Many a time have I wished that he were dead. And yet I know that I should be much more sorry than glad if he were to die. So I'm at my wit's end. So basically he's saying, being around Socrates sucks because it always makes him feel like a bad person and he has to work on himself. Then he goes on and he says, for let me tell you, none of you know him, but I will reveal him to you. Having begun, I must go on. See you how fond he is of the fair? So he always loves the beautiful. He is always with them and he's always being smitten by them. And then again, he knows nothing and is ignorant of all things. Such is the appearance which he puts on. So basically, he's kind of innocent. He loves the beautiful. He loves beautiful people, but he doesn't kind of love them in a base way, right? But then I opened him up, and I looked with him at his serious purpose. So he talked to Socrates and looked inside of him. I saw in him divine and golden images of such fascinating beauty that I was ready to do in a moment whatever Socrates commanded. They may have escaped the observation of others, but I saw them. So he sees this powerful, good, beautiful, and true stuff inside of Socrates, right? Then he talks a little bit about how he tried to seduce Socrates. He like cooked him dinner and like got him, tried to get him drunk, and then like tried to sleep next to him, and nothing worked. He could never get Socrates to kind of go with him and be with him, right? So it's a pretty comical kind of story, especially because he's like, it'd be like, you know, I don't know, some character like, it's not a good analogy, but like you could imagine like some Justin Bieber kind of character, right? Where you got this like handsome young guy who's like, you know, everybody loves this guy, but he only loves one person, and then that person doesn't at all respond to his, you know, seductive moves or whatever. So it's pretty funny. And so then going on from there, he says, whereupon I fancied that he was smitten, and then the words which I uttered like arrows had wounded him. And so without wanting to hear more, I got up and throwing my coat about him, crept away from his threadbare cloak. At that time of year was winter, and there I lay during the whole night, having this wonderful monster in my arms. Then again, Socrates will not be denied by you. And yet, notwithstanding, all he was superior to my solicitations, so contemptuous and derisive and disdainful of my beauty, which really, as I fancied, had some attractions. For judges, you shall be of the haughty virtue of Socrates. Nothing more happened. But in the morning when I awoke, let all the gods and goddesses be my witness. I arose from the couch of a father or an elder brother. So in other words, when he woke up, he realized that his relationship with Socrates was that of Socrates being like a father or an older brother. So it was not anything sexual. And so we know that the idea of platonic love comes from the symposium, right? And so here, this has been a theme throughout the symposium, that real true love is a love of a person's soul and the virtue and wisdom in that person and the good in that person, you know? And so this is where the idea of platonic love comes from. And we see philosophers later on that follow in this line and behave in the same way as Socrates. There are a few examples. So like John Stuart Mill and Spinoza, to name a few. But so then he talks a little bit about Socrates and gives us some information about the nature of Socrates, which is pretty interesting. So I'll just read a few more quotes. He says, "All this happened before he and I went on the expedition to Potidaea." So this is a military campaign. "There we messed together." So they camped together, ate together. "And I had the opportunity of observing his extraordinary power of sustaining fatigue. His endurance was simply marvelous. When being cut off from our supplies, we were compelled to go without food. On such occasions, which often happen in time of war, he was superior not only to me, but to everybody. There was no one compared to him. Yet at a festival, he was the only person who had any real powers of enjoyment. Though not willing to drink, he could, if compelled, beat us all at that. No human being had ever seen Socrates drunk, and his powers, if I'm not mistaken, will be tested before long. His fortitude in enduring cold was also surprising. Socrates, with his bare feet on ice and in his ordinary dress, marched better than the other soldiers who had shoes, and they looked daggers at him because he seemed to despise them." So the other soldiers would wear like layers and layers of clothing. They'd have like full shoes on and be freezing. And Socrates would just be wearing his like thin clothing and no shoes and be cruising right along. So, I mean, it's like he's like a superhero basically, right? And this is Alcibiades, who's a badass, talking about Socrates, right? So then he says, "While he was on expedition one morning, he was thinking about something which he could not resolve. He would not give it up, but continued thinking from early dawn until noon. There he stood fixed in thought." So he's standing and he's not moving, like we were talking about earlier, like doing a standing meditation. So he starts in the morning. So he stands there in the morning. He stands next to the camp and he's looking out into the distance. The other people are camped and they're continuing on with their normal activities of cooking and cleaning and going through the day. So there he stood fixed in thought, and at noon, attention was drawing to him. So by noon, people start going, "Wow, that guy's been standing there for like 6 hours." The wondering crowd that Socrates had been standing and thinking about something ever since the break of day. At last, in the evening after supper, some Ionians, out of curiosity — I should explain that this was not in the winter but in summer — brought out their mats and slept in the open air that they might watch him and see whether he would stand all night. So then at the end of the day, right, he's been there for 12 hours. It's midnight now. Right? Well, I guess it'd be 18 hours if it's midnight. Then they're like, "Well, we should just, let's just lay here and see how long he's going to do this." So there he stood until the following morning. "And with the return of light, he offered up a prayer to the sun and went his way." So he basically just stood there in one spot all night, didn't move, 24 hours, and then just like keeps going. So that's like hardcore standing meditation, hardcore. I mean, that is interesting, and we'll have to talk about it in another episode and talk about this practice of meditation and how it relates to the mean, how it relates to development of courage and temperance. And we'll have to take a look at that. But that, we'll save that for another time. But so anyway, that's just some interesting kinds of points about Socrates. And I'll just say a little bit more. He says, "There he stood until the following morning, and with the return of light, he offered up a prayer and went his way. I will also tell you, if you please, and indeed I'm bound to tell, of his courage in battle. For who but he saved my life? Not this was the engagement in which I received the prize of valor." So Alcibiades received the prize of valor, medal of honor, basically. "For I was wounded and he would not leave me, but he rescued me in my arms, and he ought to have received the prize of valor, which the generals wanted to confer on me, partly on account of my rank. And I told them so." So he was ranked higher than Socrates, right? But Socrates saved his life. "He tried to convince the other generals that they should give Socrates the prize. And then Socrates said, 'No, no, no, you have to give him the prize.'" And then the last little point here is, "He and lackeys were retreating, for the troops were in flight. And I met them and told them not to be discouraged and promised to remain with them. And there you might see him, Aristophanes, as you describe, just as he is in the streets of Athens, stalking like a pelican, rolling his eyes, calmly contemplating his enemies as well as his friends, and making very intelligible to anybody, even from a distance, that whoever attacked him would be likely to meet with a stout resistance. And in this way, he and his companion escaped, for this is the sort of man who is never touched in war. Those only are pursued who are running away headlong. So this is foreshadowing of Aristotle and Alexander the Great. I particularly observed how superior he was to lackeys in the presence of mind. So, and this is goes back to our discussion in lackeys, when lackeys said, even though you're younger than me, you can speak, because lackeys recognized that Socrates was his superior to him. So anyway, and I guess one more little point. Socrates basically stays up with these guys drinking all night, and they're going on and going on, and then he's talking to him about virtue and these other ideas that he has he wants to talk to people about. So he's talking to a couple of guys, and they're basically half awake. They're like, oh my God, this guy's not going to shut up. And then they basically finally fall asleep, right? And so then the symposium ends, and it says, Socrates, having laid them to sleep, rose to depart. Aristodemus, as his manner was, following him. At the Lyceum, he took a bath and passed the day as usual. In the evening, he retired to rest at his own home. So he basically stayed up all night with those guys partying. Then he goes to the gym. Then he has a whole normal day, like probably going to the market and talking to people in the gym. And then at the end of the day, he just goes to sleep. Like it's just like another day. So, I mean, that's, you know, talking about his endurance and the powerful nature of his existence, basically, you know.
Okay, so in discussing the symposium, a work noted for many reasons, it quickly becomes clear, as I'm sure listeners have recognized, the complexity, but also the diversity of opinion and the relatedness to the present day that the speeches all within it contain. It also makes it one of the greater works of Plato. The speeches spoke of Eros, the god of love, and while some praised him for being first or strongest or noblest or oldest, others noted how universal and ever-present love is. And the through line seems to be building up to the story that Socrates tells of Diotima. And through the story, we again see the importance of wisdom, the good, the true, the beautiful. And we're also reminded of the notion of forms, which we see in many of Plato's works, and the world that exists outside of humans, but that humans have access to. Lastly, we kind of get this argument that love is like a spirit going between the humans and the gods, almost like a mediator or some sort of way to reach the gods. So before getting into a couple questions here, I'd like to just make a couple points. So one is, I thought it was interesting, and it's telling of Greek society to some degree, because just as all the individuals speak to different definitions of love, the ancient Greek language itself also had around 8 different words that correspond to different types of love. So we'll start with Eros, which is romantic or passionate love. It's named obviously after the Greek god of fertility. And this is like a lust, a pleasure, a loss of control kind of love. Then you had philia, which is like an affectionate love, right? Or a friendship love. Or, you know, you might also call it a platonic love. So it's without physical attraction, and where like Philadelphia comes from, right? City of brotherly love. And philosophy, right? The love of wisdom. Agape, which is selfless or universal love. So this is like love for strangers, nature, or God. Some kind of unconditional, bigger than ourselves, boundless compassion love. Storge, which is a familiar love. This is a natural form of affection experienced between family members. So this is like a protective, kinship-based kind of love, common between parents or children, that kind of thing. It can also be patriotism for one's country, but it's usually within the family context. Then there's mania, which that's like an obsessive sort of love. So this is like obsession, stalking behaviors, codependency, extreme jealousy. You know, some might even throw violence in there, but mania, right? Ludus is a playful love. So this is like a situation of having a crush and then acting on it, or kind of like love between young lovers. There's pragma, which is enduring love. That's love built on commitment, understanding, and long-term best interests. So that's like an aged or matured love about compromise and making a relationship work over time. And then lastly, you have philosia, which is self-love. And so this is the idea that in order to care for others, you have to care for yourself. And this goes to Aristotle's mention that all friendly feelings for others are an extension of a man's feelings for himself. So I guess I would like to just open this up by noting the way in which this is organized. You know, there seems to be a couple things to note from this, and I'll get your take on this. But one is that, as we see, it starts with speeches that slowly lead up to Socrates. And each of these individuals who give the speeches, like Eryximachus, for example, represents medicine, and they represent different, there's a playwright, right, that kind of thing. They represent different roles, if you might call it, within society, or even professions, or something like that. Comedy is Aristophanes, tragedy is Agathon. So do you think that this is kind of like Plato showing that he values philosophy, which is obviously exemplified by Socrates, over other arts? That's the first point. Then the second point would be, which is a related point, do you think that the notion in which they stagger these speeches, slowly getting more and more, I don't want to call it informational, but maybe more insightful, right? Do you think that that is also kind of like a way in showing how one must approach philosophy in general, you know, with kind of like the allegory of the cave, how that was presented?
Oh, those are great points. Those are great points. And I think that you're right on all counts there. I think that Plato does look down on other things, obviously, and thinks that the only real thing is philosophy. The only thing that really matters is philosophy. And that there's nothing wrong with being a good poet, and there's nothing wrong with being a good playwright. There's nothing wrong with making good music, but just make sure you run it by the philosophers first and make sure it's okay. You know? So that, you know, I think you're right about that. And then you've got this idea of, you know, different people. I think it's good if you're trying to capture the landscape of an idea, as we've said before, to have different people from different roles in life kind of putting in their perspective so that we can get a more robust full picture of things. At the same time, I think it does kind of build up to the peak is when Socrates is talking about his teacher and basically giving his idea of love being about the true and the good and the beautiful and not a physical thing. And then we get this kind of way in which it comes full circle with Alcibiades showing up intoxicated and talking about his lust for Socrates and then talking about how great Socrates is, which is a way for Plato to get that across and say, look, this guy is like more than a normal human. That point was made continually in the symposium, actually, because people were talking about Apollodorus and Alcibiades were talking about how they wouldn't even pay attention to anybody else other than Socrates. So it is interesting, right? So, I mean, I guess that's what I would think about that.
Just one other thing to talk about, Diotima. I think it's really interesting that in some ways she represents the state of attained wisdom. And she's almost like a godlike figure. And Socrates almost becomes like what we would call love, which is the access, the bridge to the god, because he's obviously the one conveying it to the people there, right? And so I think it's interesting how she's kind of this unapproachable figure. So in a way, it elevates her, but obviously, as you mentioned, she's not present at the banquet, right? The symposium, if you will. So in some ways, it's like he brings her into it, but elevates her to a god status, and he kind of operates the way he mentions she says love is to the gods, he is to the people.
Oh, that's great. That's a great, great insight. Now that's a good, really good point. And the funny thing is, right, it is like she's elevated. And so some people say that before the kind of idea of a triune God involving the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, right? So you've got the Holy Spirit, you've got the Father and the Son. But there used to be a feminine aspect to this, and that was wisdom, was feminine. And so we know the goddess Athena is a goddess of wisdom. That's feminine. Right. So it turns out that the idea of wisdom is a feminine idea. And somewhere along the line that was kind of removed or taken out of the idea. And then some people say that's because of patriarchy or something like that. Right. So who knows about that? But it is interesting that the idea of wisdom is feminine. And here we have that being embodied by Socrates' teacher. Right.
Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, I hope that everyone gets as much out of this as we did. I think it's one of those pieces where, like many of Plato's works, every now and then you revisit it and you just kind of get something different. And it just goes to show not only the depth of who we are as humans and what we're able to access, but also what written works that have been here, you know, for over 2,000 years, what those are able to convey to us that has already been known and, you know, is just waiting to be discovered. So I hope our conversation helps you in your search for truth. And I want to thank you all for listening, and we hope to see you next time as we search for truth on the road that never ends.